From your morning podcast to your afternoon playlist, you know you personalize your entire day. That's why State Farm helps you personalize your insurance with the State Farm Personal Price Plan. That's a lot of B's.
Yeah.
It offers coverage options that help protect what you care about most at an affordable price just for you. That's important. You want an affordable price.
Yeah, I do want one.
Yeah, if it's too much, well, that's just not going to happen.
No.
State Farm's on it. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices vary by state. I'm lowering my voice.
I know.
Options selected by customer. Availability and eligibility may vary. Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend is sponsored by ADT. Introducing ADT self-setup, featuring everything from motion sensors to Google Nest cams and the Nest doorbell with a battery or wired option. Easily install the ADT self-setup security system at your convenience. This is so good because I can't set up anything.
I know, me neither.
And they've made it simple. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm terrible. I can't get an electric toothbrush to function properly.
Yeah, so easy even Conan O'Brien can do it.
That's what they should say from now on. Yeah. No heavy-duty tools are needed. And if you need help, ADT can provide virtual assistance along the way. Also features Nest cams that can tell the difference between a person, an animal, a vehicle, or with the Nest doorbell, even a package.
That's cool.
That's cool. Plus, when every second counts, you can trust ADT's 24/7 professional monitoring. Go to ADT.com today or call 1-800-ADT-ASAP. Google, Nest Cam, Nest Doorbell, and Nest Aware are trademarks of Google LLC.
Hi, I'm Hillary Clinton.
And hi, my name is Chelsea Clinton.
And I feel great, but a little apprehensive about being Conan O'Brien's friend.
Wow.
It could be that we could become really good friends, mm-hmm. and I don't know what that would mean for my life. It could also be a great adventure.
It could be. It's about a 20% chance.
Well, you know,
for you.
I've had better and worse odds.
And I feel like I have better odds than my mom.
Really?
So maybe I'm at like 30-70?
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell, brand new shoes, walking blues, climb the fence, books and pens, I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Hello there, and welcome to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. It's the way to experience Conan O'Brien in a more pleasing fashion without seeing my face, and you can stop it at any time.
Not for Sona and me.
That's right. Well, you know, I was about to introduce you, Gorla. You didn't let me introduce you. I'm
Politics.
Joined by my trusty interrupter, the producer, Matt Gorley.
Hi.
And Sonam Avsesian, who can barely be bothered to be here.
Yeah. Hello.
You were a little late today. What was going on there?
I went to look at a house.
You? Oh.
I don't want to talk about house shopping anymore.
Right, because you think it's giving you a bad mojo?
No, because I hate it. I'm so unhappy.
Well, can I just say, just so that the listeners know a little bit about our world, is that Sona has been and her husband have been looking for a house for, would you say, seriously, like 9 months, a year?
A year.
And you've looked at over 200 houses.
Easily.
Yeah.
Awful.
What if you just went to REI, bought a tent? I mean, and that way you have your own place, you can get the feel. They have really nice, have you been to, I mean, listen, we're not getting any money from REI. This is completely my own tangent here. My wife says REI is my happy place.
Oh, wow.
I love stores that have gear.
Yeah.
And so I will go, and it's gear I don't use because I don't go camping. I don't go hiking.
I get this.
But I love to go and look at their tents. Mm-hmm. They have like 600 tents. Now, I'm telling you, I've never bought a tent in my life. And when I used to, you know, when I was a kid and I went to camp, we had tents and they were terrible. They were left over from the Korean War and they were made of canvas and they leaked. But these tents they have are so incredible, and they have like adjoining rooms that fold out.
Yeah.
And like a clock tower. You know, they're just amazing. And then I love to go and look at all of the lost in the wilderness things. Like this fits inside your boot, but it starts a fire, and this turns into a corned beef sandwich if you add one drop of sunflower oil. You know, I love that store. Yeah, and again, I'm telling you, not a dime.
It's aspirational. Is that what it is? Like you're there just thinking, like imagining a different life, kind of?
You want to be that guy.
I want to be the guy who actually uses all that stuff.
Yeah.
And who needs a watch that tells me what my cholesterol is and where I am on a mountain, like what elevation.
Yeah. Well, why don't you do it? You could go camping in the forest.
I'd be killed immediately.
Proposition.
Yeah, that's
the three of us go camping and we record a podcast.
Oh, I'm busy that day.
Really?
Because I'm busy that day.
At night.
This is my nightmare.
Would you really not do it? Why?
Going on a trip with the two of you?
Yeah.
I don't want to do that.
Why not?
I understand going on a trip with him would be problematic, but you have an issue with going with me?
Listen, I feel like the two of you would talk about like World War II the whole time.
I see. Yeah.
And about like, I don't know.
About what? Just say.
I don't know, uniforms. The uniforms people wore and the
what are you talking about?
The chairs people sat on and the model of the knives they held.
It
would have
been a K-bar probably from World War II.
Oh, God. Yeah. This is awful. No, I'm never going on a trip with the two of you.
We wouldn't talk. Who would talk about the chair? Speaking of which, by the way, the chair that General Lee sat on at the signing of Appomattox.
Okay.
Do you know who took it as a souvenir?
Who?
General George Armstrong Custer.
Oh, my God.
He got it as a keepsake. He took it and walked away with it, only to die in 1876, July to be exact. No, I think we would actually have a really good time.
We would.
You know, I think it depends on how much we brought. I don't want to do the real survivalist thing. Okay, let's go find a snake and eat it.
Yeah,
I don't
want to do that. No glamping either. Just actual camping.
What do you mean no glamping?
Well, no yurts with baths.
No. I don't want to do a yurt with baths. But I'd like to bring some high quality wine.
Yeah. Sounds good.
Would you poop in the forest?
I don't do that. I'm on television.
He poops on television.
No,
If we go camping and there's no bathroom, would you dig a hole?
No, I don't have
a hole.
I don't have those needs. I'm someone who exists digitally on the podcast and on television.
You're AI.
I don't urinate. I don't defecate.
Okay.
I don't.
You don't defecate.
No, I don't. I simply do not. I am what you think I am.
Really?
Yeah. That's the cleaned up version of Popeye.
I am what you think I am.
That's what a Popeye originally said. I am what you think. And then it got perverted, and he was at sea a long time. And he was eating so much canned spinach, which, by the way, back then had all kinds of bad stuff in it. And it became I am what I am. Poor Popeye. And then he lost one of his eyes. We don't know how. Anyway.
Well, from defecation into former Secretary of State? Should we do this?
Oh, God. There's no good way. We can't.
Can't do this one.
We can.
Yeah. We were doing really well and perfectly fine, and then you brought up pooping out of nowhere. So thanks for nothing.
But it is part of camping, is pooping in a hole.
Would you just stop?
Kept going with it. You said you don't urinate or defecate.
We have high-class guests today, and you're being incredibly inappropriate. Seriously. And so I just want you to try and clean up your act.
You rolled with the pooping.
Yeah. Stop saying it. Be quiet.
You poop. You were talking about pooping.
Pee pee.
You two are the worst.
Pee poopy.
Poopy pee pee.
Pee pee pee. Poop poop poop.
My guests today are two extraordinary women. Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, you're both going to hell. The first female senator for New York and the first woman to earn a major party's nomination for president, and Chelsea Clinton, the best-selling author and global health advocate. Together, they've authored The Book of Gutsy Women, Favorite Stories of Courage and Resilience, Hillary and Chelsea Clinton. Glad that you're just coming into the room now and you didn't hear the introduction. It's so nice to have you here. Welcome. Talk about how things have changed. When you played basketball, they made you play half-court basketball?
Half-court basketball, yes.
And that was for a specific reason. Women had to play half-court basketball. Why?
We never really knew. They had all kinds of excuses. The excuses were, we think it would be bad for women's hearts. We don't think women can run that far. I mean, these were all the things we were told.
That's insane.
And so as we've been going around on the book tour, so many women of a certain age, like Cecile Richards, our great friend, just interviewed us in Austin, Texas. And she said, I played half-court basketball. And she was like a good basketball player.
Yeah,
I was, you know, mediocre, but I loved the game. And so you'd have three on each side. You would have to pass over the center line in order to get the ball to, you know, your forwards to score. And the whole thing was so ludicrous because in our rules, you also could only dribble three times because apparently that was also bad for our hearts.
What are they? They're thinking of like, it's bad for your heart. So basically, basically, we know that you, it's okay for you to give birth to right. multiple children.
That's right.
But three dribbles on the basketball.
That's it.
And I think that should do it, sweetie.
Yeah, sorry, exactly.
That's insane. Well, you know,
sexism has never been about science.
No. I'm telling you, I'm a scientist. Four dribbles will kill a woman.
Exactly.
I played quarter court basketball. That was my own decision. It just people saw me moving, and I looked like a large bird that had been injured.
You know, maybe someday we can play half court. I'll show you how
really?
To play.
Really? Anytime you want to play half court with me.
Absolutely, yeah.
And how many dribbles do I get?
Oh, three, if you're going to play by the half court rules.
All right, well, you heard it here. I will be playing half court three dribble basketball with Secretary Clinton, and you'll see that very soon on the internet.
That's true.
You know, we just sat down. It's really lovely having you both here.
Thank you.
And very impressed by the book of gutsy women. I was stunned at the number of women in this book that obviously there were women that I expected to be in the book. And then there were a bunch of names that I'll admit, I was not aware. I was not aware of a bunch of these names. And I would read their story, and I was completely blown away. And I have a 16-year-old daughter who is not thrilled with being my friend.
That will pass.
We grow out of it. We grow out of it.
Do we? Do we grow out of it?
We do.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. That's part of the process.
Okay. Well, I want to start there because I'm very impressed that a mother and a daughter wrote a book together. Because if I wrote a book with my mom, I think the title would be "Why Won't He Sit Up Straight?" And why didn't he consider law school? And so we would
that means you cleaned your room.
No, I was not great at cleaning my room. There's a lot of things as you know, Chelsea, there's stuff when you have, there's daughter, mother stuff that is so fraught. That's my wife's favorite word, is fraught. My wife and my daughter can get into something that's about nothing, seemingly. Mm-hmm. And my son and I will walk in and they're suddenly both crying, weeping because of something involving a teaspoon or a sugar spoon. And my son and I just silently back out of the room because it's fraught, but you guys managed to pull this off. Were you worried at all? Because there's obviously got to be differences in styles in the way you approach writing and the way you approach building something like this.
Well, I should let Chelsea go first because she was on the receiving end of fraughtness. And so I think she would have a certain perspective, but it is part of the, you know, whole effort to seek independence and find your own way and construct your own identity. So I'm not at all surprised.
Here would be the difference. The difference, Secretary Clinton, is that you can say, just had an argument, she stormed out when she was 16 or 17. Find out from the Secret Service where she is.
That's true.
That's an advantage.
Yeah, it
do you
is
know what
an advantage.
I mean?
I also think, I realize now, particularly as a parent, you know, and my husband, as he would acknowledge, was quite rebellious. And I think I was painfully unrebellious. Mm-hmm. So I never really stormed out. In fact, I had a mom who would come in on Friday nights when I was 16 and say, you know, you really don't need to do your physics homework. Like, you should go be with your friends. But I was so nerdy and, like, painfully type A. And so I really needed my mom to kind of prod and push me. And I'm so thankful that she did because I think so many of the friendships that I still treasure, you know, wouldn't have been as meaningful in high school or throughout my life if I hadn't had my mom continually kind of pushing me out into the world.
You were doing that? You were saying you've got to get out there. You've got to hit the clubs. Come on.
Well, not quite that. Well, more just like go over to your friend's house and watch a movie, but make sure you're back by 10 o'clock.
Oh, okay.
No, well, look, I think you made a funny point, which was an accurate one. So she lived her teenage years out in the White House, which is a bizarre place to be a teenager, obviously. But she did have Secret Service protection, which meant that if she did go to a party or she did go out, you know, I didn't have to worry all that much.
Right.
But it, you know, look, I think it's much harder being a parent of a teenager today. I think even forget about growing up in the White House. I just think it's harder no matter where you live with your kids. There's just so much else going on in the world to demand their attention, distract them, create anxiety, depression about they're not good enough, they're not this enough or that enough.
And really, so much of it's the internet.
It
That's what we have
so
found.
So much, Conan. It is so much the internet.
What happens is my wife and I made all these decisions about what we were going to do. And my wife is an amazing mom, and I think she's done an amazing job, and I haven't gotten too much in the way. But what has happened is technology and the internet has blown up so much that our rule about no screens can just, it becomes impractical. You got to let them watch some screens. They have to have phones somewhat for their safety and to communicate and be part of the world. But then it just gets... It's fighting a constant battle, which you haven't hit yet. So I can talk very condescendingly to you.
Well, and I hope give advice, because right now we do exercise total dictatorial control. Right. And thankfully, my kids think it's like a huge deal when they get to watch something and not anything they have kind of agency over. But I know that's because they're 5'3". And well, I mean, the 3-month-old doesn't watch anything. But like, I know that will change. And I know we have to be ready for that.
The other big change agent is grandparents. Grandparents love to slide in, and correct me if I'm wrong, Secretary Clinton, you love to, it's fun to slide in, and when the when your kids are gone and you're looking after the grandkids, I've seen this with both sets of grandparents. They love to give them everything we don't give them because you get away scot-free, and you're a hero.
Absolutely. I think it's one of the joys of being a grandparent is to be a little subversive.
Yes.
I had that experience with my mom and Bill's mom when it came to Chelsea. They literally would give me just, you know, of course, and then go off and do exactly the opposite of what I had asked them to do or and even more not do. So, we feel lucky to be close enough to our grandkids that we can see them a lot. Mm-hmm. And when we do have them, look, if it's 2-on-2, you're outnumbered. So whatever we can do to just make them happy, we're willing to do. So pizza for lunch and dinner, that's fine.
You're basically admitting to breaking all the rules that Chelsea set up when she
Chelsea
left.
Chelsea sets all the rules.
Yes.
And then, you know, we kind of say, oh, well, just this once. It wouldn't make that big a difference.
Right.
Yeah.
An eclair for breakfast.
Whatever.
<It's> perfectly.
Just so they're happy.
There's unlimited octonauts.
Screen time does help grandparents deal with, you know, all that goes on in a little kid's life.
I relate to you, Secretary Clinton, because I know that you had a difference in working style for this book. And I relate more to your style. I know that Chelsea's all about...
I'm outnumbered.
Well, I'm sorry, but you should have done your research. I am 88 years old. I just had a ton of surgery.
And look really good
Thank
for your
you.
Age.
Thank you. It's a fortune to keeping this thing going.
This is why you live in Los Angeles.
Exactly, yeah. Now, the Irish don't move to Los Angeles to look younger. If I go outside for 5 minutes, you can smell cooking ham. But I know that you work on... you're high-tech... You've grown up in that world and you're familiar with it, so you're working off a computer, and then you would ask for your mom's draft and she would give you handwritten
Yes, notes. I write in longhand for books, you know, obviously for other things, you know, using the computer is fine, but for a book, I can only think if my hand is actually holding a pen and moving across a page. Chelsea knew that, but I don't think she realized quite how much a burden it would place on her because, you know, she is, you know, she loves Google Docs.
I live
Docs.
In 2019.
Yeah, she thinks she's a very modern person.
What's that like in 2019? Tell me about that, because I don't. I write stuff longhand, and then a carrier pigeon takes it to somebody. And, I mean, I want to go as old school as possible. I would use a quill if I could. I really would. It's what I'm comfortable with. I don't know why I'm such a throwback. But
I'm not going to try to find a quill and ink pot and send it to you for Christmas, Conan. And then I expect you to send a photograph of yourself with the quill.
Guess what? You will lose this wager because I will use the quill and then I will write you. And then people will intervene and tell me to.
Well, that means that the odds of our friendship are just going to go up.
I know, exactly. So. Yeah. I wanted to quickly tell you. One of the reasons why this book resonates with me is that my mom, Ruth O'Brien, who came from a very middle-class family in Worcester, Massachusetts, got a full scholarship to Vassar, and then she was one of the early women to go to Yale. law school.
Oh, wow.
And she graduated in 1956. And she told a story, and she's always been this heroic figure in my life. I love my dad, too, and he's a great man. But my mom, she told this story that in around 1957, 58, when she started working at a law firm in Boston, she's a graduate of Yale Law School. She did very well. She was working at a high-powered firm in Boston. She went to a meeting of the other lawyers. She's the only woman. They're all working. They finish their work and it's time to break for lunch. They all go into the dining room, but it's a men's only dining room. So they set up a card table, and my mom sat at the card table, and she said, two of the other young associates were very nice, so they sat with me at the card table, literally a kid's card table. What always blew me away is not just the story that if that happened today, that would be a $100 million lawsuit. What blew me away is that my mother had no anger about it, none. She said that's just what it was. And I think one of the things that resonates with me in this book is optimism.
Well, that's really one of the themes of the book, which you picked up on, because despite what they encountered and the obstacles that they had to overcome, they remained optimistic. They remained optimistic about their own goals, their own purpose in life, and they remained optimistic that they could make a positive difference. And I think part of the beauty of the 103 women stories that we tell is that there's something for everybody to relate to. But I'm thinking about the story of your mom, because at the time that she was practicing law, late 50s, she was in a very small group of women who had gone to law school, had gotten jobs. Remember, Sandra Day O'Connor was basically told she couldn't get a job as a lawyer. She could work as a secretary. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, same kind of experiences. So when they got that job, they wanted to prove themselves. Right. And they had to do that by sitting at the card table, you know, showing that they were willing to, you know, do the work and take a little bit of the blowback that institutionally they still had to deal with, because they wanted to prove themselves. And this was the women of a prior generation's, you know, means of demonstrating that they belonged. And, you know, now we can take a lot of optimism, but we can also say part of what we've had to do since then is to knock down all the barriers, as many as we can, so that a woman like your mom wouldn't find herself in that position. She would be judged, you know, solely on the basis of, you know, how her work measured up. So the optimism is really deep. You know, we say these are favorite stories of courage and resilience. You have to be optimistic to have courage and resilience, because lots of times it's just easier to walk away, or when you're knocked down, stay down, or when you're, you know, somewhat demeaned by go sit in that card table, not in the men's, you know, room. Right. You got to take a deep breath, and you got to decide what's important to you, and you've got to be optimistic enough that the path you choose is going to turn out well for you and help others along the way.
You know, and Conan, one of the women we write about, Vera Rubin, went to Vassar around the same time as your mom, and she knew she wanted to pursue a doctorate in physics, and she really wanted to go to Princeton. Although the faculty supported her, she was turned down because even then, there were no women allowed into the kind of Princeton physics PhD program, and it wouldn't be until 1975 when that changed.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be until after Title IX. And we write about Title IX in the book and its kind of profound effect on athletics, that kind of before Title IX in the early 1970s, there were about 700 girls playing competitive high school soccer, and last year there were 390,000. But it also had a huge impact on opening opportunities for women in academia. And, you know, Vera Rubin is considered kind of one of the Nobel Prize's inexplicable misses. I mean, she helped prove dark matter, which is the majority of the universe. And yet, kind of, she wasn't recognized for that. But one of her kind of proudest achievements, as she said, kind of at the end of her life, were the truly hundreds of young scientists, and particularly women, that she'd mentored. And part of what we wanted to show in this book, kind of about these gutsy women, is that so often, kind of, their optimism was expressed through kind of breaking down barriers and bringing others along. That it really was about
a sense of community.
Yeah, the community and building the future and empowering the future in a really profound way.
What's fascinating to me, these things that we think existed a, quote, long time ago, just happened. I mean, Secretary Clinton, you're writing about how when you were a young girl, there was one comic in the newspaper, which is Brenda Starr.
Right.
And Brenda Starr, no one was looking at Brenda Starr when I was a kid. I mean, I was a big fan. but nobody was really, you know, but Brenda Starr was really the one comic book character that was sort of meant to empower young women. And then there's Nancy Drew. And then that's kind of it. And then you have to go looking.
That was absolutely the world I grew up in. And that was one of the fascinating differences between Chelsea and me when it came to thinking back about who inspired me when I was a little girl. And there weren't very many women in our school lessons when I was in elementary school or junior high school, even high school that I can remember. I mean, you know, famous women would be mentioned like Elizabeth I or Cleopatra. But other than that, there wasn't a lot of discussion at all about, you know, roles that women had played. Amelia Earhart, who I discovered when I was a little girl. Margaret Burke White, who was the first war correspondent who traveled the world following the incredible exploits of the American soldiers in World War II. Helen Keller, who I learned about on a TV show. Margaret Chase Smith, the Republican senator from Maine, who took on Joe McCarthy. I would come across these women, and my mother would be very encouraging. She would tell me about people she had read about, or she would take me to the library. But that was beyond my personal experience. My personal experience was the only women I knew who worked outside the home were my teachers and, you know, my public librarians. I never knew a woman lawyer like your mom. That was just not in my atmosphere.
Like, it would have been like seeing an alien if you saw a woman doctor.
I wouldn't have even understood it. Yeah. A woman doctor, no. A woman lawyer, no. A woman who owned a business, no. I just didn't know them. I know they were there, but they were not part of my upbringing. And by the time Chelsea was a little girl, that had begun to change. And there were a lot more role models and a lot more examples that you could actually point to and say, you could do this or you could be that. I mean, one of our favorite characters in the Book of Gutsy Women is Sally Ride. And she famously said something that we talk about a lot.
It's hard to imagine what you can't see.
Right.
And when I was growing up in Little Rock, yes, my teachers and the public librarians were still predominantly women. But, you know, when I was in first grade, our mayor was a woman. My principal was a woman. My pediatrician was a woman, who then later went on to be the head of the children's hospital in Arkansas. And my mother also didn't have to work as hard as her mother had had to work to kind of bring role models into her life.
Right. I mean, they were readily accessible.
They were readily accessible. I mean, one of my earliest memories, Conan, is going to see Geraldine Ferraro in 1984 when she came to campaign in Little Rock. And so it was just so much easier for my mother to help me imagine what was possible because it was in my lived kind of everyday life.
Right.
And you know, she did go to space camp when she
I did go to space camp.
Oh, my God. My son went to a kind of a space camp.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing that there was probably a time where 25, 30 years ago, if you did go, it would seem odd, you know, like, well, what is she doing?
I just didn't really care about seeming odd. I was obsessed with kind of outer space and Sally Ride. And so I went to space camp in Huntsville, Alabama, and it was awesome. And I am sure that a lot of people in my school were like, she's so weird. And I just like, thankfully, could have cared less.
I'm here to tell you that being thought of as weird when you're young often turns out.
Does that, that turns out okay?
Well, better for you than for me.
I don't know about
but
that.
Well, I'm just saying.
I'm getting less apprehensive every minute.
Thank you. I can see your shoulders dropping.
Yeah, yeah, very relaxed.
You seem, you really seem like you're starting to accept me. You know, one of the things I want to ask you about in terms of feeling weird is I know that you went out one Halloween as Joan of Arc.
Oh, I did.
How old were you when you went out as Joan of Arc? And here's my second question. Did anyone in your family explain to you what happened to Joan of Arc?
I think I did know the end of her story.
Because it would be really sad if you went, Mommy, Daddy, I'm Joan of Arc. Oh, that's great, honey. Yeah, can you tell me what happened at the end? What kind of candy did you get? Well, I'll talk about that in a minute. What happened at the end?
Yeah, my grandmother, my mom's mom, was a hugely important person in my life for many reasons, including that she made my Halloween costumes. And I had all sorts of, maybe this is a perfect continuation of how kind of
zany and nerdy and weird I was as a kid. Like, I was a peacock and an ice cream cone and Joan of Arc, I think, like, in three consecutive years.
Yes.
You're like, yes, you were zany.
A bird,
and
a dairy product, and then this martyr. Yes.
And
not my, a natural 1, 2, 3.
So I don't, I mean, I was probably like 8 or 9 when I was Joan of Arc. And I had the whole, like, white tunic with the red cross, and my grandmother made me what looked like a chain link belt, and I had a shield and a kind of hat.
Right, right.
And I just remember that that was a really frustrating Halloween because I kept having to explain who I was.
Yeah, those are the worst.
Yeah.
You're like, well, okay.
I was like, trick or treat. And you're like, who are you? And I was like, Joan of Arc.
Let's talk about the papacy. It's about 600 years ago. You have to sit people down and really talk about it. Sona, where else can you go surfing and skiing the same day, huh?
I don't know.
Or check out a world-class art museum and then camp at a dark sky sanctuary that night, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, where else can you hike through redwoods and then get a luxury spa treatment?
Where?
Well, you live there. California. California, Sona. No matter where
California.
You go across the state, you'll find a way to play. I'm a California resident, so are you. Sona, you are a lifelong California resident.
I'm a lifer. I love this place.
This is a beautiful state. Gorgeous. So many different, wonderful ecosystems in one state. You can hang out by a Palm Springs pool. You know, you can go whale watching. You can go hiking in Yosemite. And then talk about the great cities in California. You get all this amazing food, sushi, whatever you want. They got it in California. Hey, if you can't find it in California, man, you got a problem.
Yeah.
I shouldn't have done that. I made that up on my own. Anyway, I love California. Discover why California is the ultimate playground. Head to visitcalifornia.com to start planning your trip today. Sona, what would you do with $100 billion? Seriously.
Oh, I would buy a country.
Okay. I would buy just a ton of yachts and private jets, and I would duct tape them all together and then just have it go in a circle in the Pacific Ocean.
What?
Yeah. I don't know, just to be a total jerk. Anyway, there is a correct answer.
Oh.
And it's build incredible cities in fantastical locations while competing with your friends to be the biggest tycoon in the world. What do you think of that answer?
That's better than mine.
Yep, and mine, which you can do with Monopoly Go, the hit mobile game that's so much fun, it's been downloaded over 150 million times. It's the fun of classic Monopoly on the go, anytime, anywhere, endless new surprises like tons of boards and crazy mini games. You can team up with your chums on community chess and tournaments to get big money, or you can go after their fortune changing rent on your properties or even pulling a bank heist on them. So much fun. It's incredible. So start building up your billions today. Go download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store and Google Play. You know, it's incredible to have the flexibility to work in all sorts of places, whether it's taking video calls from the park or emailing large files while you're grocery shopping. Sona, this is good for you.
Is it?
Because you're always doing whatever work you do for me from fun locations.
But I like blaming it on not having reception.
I know, but you can't do that here. Working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network, which is why you should check out T-Mobile, Sona.
Okay.
Then you got no excuses. They're America's largest and fastest 5G network. With T-Mobile, you'll be covered in more places with the 5G speed you need for your life on the go. Plus, they also cover more highway miles with 5G than anybody else. Check it out if you don't believe me. Hey, Blay, you've got T-Mobile, right?
I do. I was actually just up in the woods in Idlewild. It was fantastic for the weekend, and my T-Mobile phone didn't miss it.
You know, I wouldn't think you'd need a cell phone because you speak so loudly into a microphone.
Well, I had to look some stuff up.
Just take it down.
I didn't know when brunch was.
I can hear him.
When the restaurant's open for brunch.
Okay.
So I used my T-Mobile coverage to check out brunch.
That's all right. Anyway, wherever you are, you know, take it from the loudspeaking Blay. If you're on the go, you want to be in the know, you want to make the show.
What?
T-Mobile. Okay. That's the one for you.
That was
I should
weird.
Have rhymed it with go. Anyway, find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today. Coverage not available in some areas. Fastest based on median overall combined 5G speeds, according to analysis by Ookla of Speed Test Intelligence Data Q3 2023. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com. I wanted to, just the personal experience that I had that involves both of you, that has always struck me, and I've recounted it many times to people, but in the 90s, during your administration, you and your husband's administration, I was invited, very kindly invited to an Irish-American dinner at the White House. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget this. This is, you know, huge deal. I'm not getting any invites these days, but that's okay. Check the mailbox every day. But I went to this event at the White House, and there was a receiving line, and I shook hands with the president and with you, and we're all sitting, I believe, I could be wrong, but I think we were sitting outside or someplace that seemed like it was sort of outside. Beautiful night. What a great occasion. I'm so aware. And then at some point, you're walking sort of from table to table saying hi to people, and you're a kid, and you walked over to our table. And we all said, oh, hi, Chelsea, how are you? And I don't, you know, didn't know who we were, but you were very nice. And you said, yeah, I was trying to do my homework upstairs. And there's just all this noise, but this happens whenever they have state dinners. And it's hard to concentrate. And my mind exploded. And I think you also said you had tried to practice an instrument. I think you had an instrument of some.
It's possible.
And you were like, you know, some impractical instrument, like a xylophone or something. And you're like, I'm upstairs and I'm trying to do this, but state dinners. And I just thought,
I'm a terrible actress, Gordon. So it's just whatever is in my head doesn't to come out of my mouth.
What I love, first of all, everybody at the table loved it, and I've never forgotten it. And I thought, what a great. My first thought was, your parents are doing a good job. I don't know much, but your parents are doing a really good job because you are a kid. And you're a kid who's living in the White House, whose attitude is, I'm trying to get this stuff done, and this is annoying because the prime minister of Ireland is here and all these Irish people. And
don't they know I have a test tomorrow?
I have a test tomorrow. And I really thought
back to being so nerdy that I was like, if this is going to take my grade from A to B, that's just not acceptable.
Exactly. Yeah. And you probably like, and I'm talking to this guy who's on what at 12:30 at night? Who even watches them? Who are you? What happened to Letterman? You know? And
just like, you're giving me too many cool points.
Okay. Well, whatever.
Too many cool points.
But anyway, I was very impressed.
Sorry,
that
I was so.
No, you were great.
Homework and instrument focused.
No, I guess the point I was making is I saw this snapshot of, this is a.
Tried to be normal.
Family who is normalizing the least normal situation in the world.
True.
And
true.
How do you do that?
It is really hard. But I think, you know, for us, it was an effort since neither Bill nor I had had any kind of. Opportunity to live the way a president lives, you know, mm-hmm. with people taking care of you and cooking for you and doing all of the stuff that makes a huge house run. So we just were determined to try to make her life as normal as possible. So yeah, she
had chores.
She had chores. She had to.
How do you have chores at the White House?
You got to clean your own room. Which,
no, you don't.
Yes, you do.
Calling in Delta Force.
Yeah,
clean this room.
I mean, you know, this child is going to be.
It's got some Navy SEALs in here to clean this.
Yeah, no.
There are so many workarounds you could have used, Chelsea, if you
but
wanted
then,
to.
But then we also, you know, we said she had to learn how to do things like, you know, wash your own clothes and iron them and learn to cook. And so, yeah, because otherwise you could come out of that experience like, totally
warped,
not only warped, just kind of dependent on other people
helpless.
To take care
yeah.
of you.
And yeah.
and who wants to be that?
Yeah. No. Well, I mean,
I'd like to take a shot at it.
It's too late.
No, it's not. You have no, my ability for sloth is unrivaled. I would like to take a shot at it.
Well, keep trying to get an invitation to the White House, and I can tell you some, places to hide. They won't find you for months, and who knows what might come from that.
Great. Yeah, if you could, we'll have a talk off mic.
Yeah, okay. You'll tell me. Right. Yeah, I don't want everybody to go.
There's a room. Just pull on. It's this Encyclopedia Britannica. They're
what are called safe rooms, you know, hidden spaces that, you know, you wouldn't know are there. Great. So, yeah, I can help you on that.
Okay, thank you very much.
And bring back the Irish to the White House. I mean, really, what is the problem here?
Well, I am Irish, and no, I don't think the Irish should be the White House.
God, we had so much fun at those parties, though. We had a party every St. Patrick's Day. We had the state dinner that you're talking about. We really had a good time.
It was really magical, and I was very impressed with, just before the podcast started, you're talking about, talking to your kids over the internet and how that's frustrating because you want to be there right now. And it's like the same thing that my wife would be talking about in this very same situation. And I think that gets lost.
It does.
A lot.
It's so easy, and probably always has been, but I think it's even easier now, to get reduced to a caricature. And sometimes it's a positive caricature, sometimes it's a negative, but it doesn't do justice to the full human being that somebody is in whatever area of enterprise, whether it's politics or entertainment. And it always surprises me because, you know, I'll meet somebody and you can see them kind of looking at me through slightly narrowed eyes. And, you know, I'll say hello and talk to them and everything. They'll say, "You're so much nicer than I thought you'd be." And I said, I'm sorry about that. That's too bad. I'm sorry that you had that impression. But it's better than the people who think that I've killed, you know, at least 50 people or done some other crazy stuff because they see it on the internet. And so when my friends meet somebody, especially during the last campaign, they'd be knocking on doors saying, "Please vote for Hillary Clinton." They, "Oh, sorry, I can't do that. She kills people." And they say, "Oh, yeah, I've known her since sixth grade. I don't think that's true." They say, "Oh, yeah, but I saw it on the internet."
Yeah.
I saw it on the internet. And so it's a really complicated world we find ourselves in right now to make sense of it, to hold on to the humanity that each one of us has and wants to keep, and to try to figure out how we're going to create much better and fuller images of people who are in the public eye. It's really tough.
I think we're at this time, American politics has always been nasty. That's not new.
True.
And I always like to point out to people that George Washington had a very difficult second term where people criticized him. And I thought, it's George Washington. He's the first one. There was nothing really controversial at that time about George Washington. And yet the second term, people were like, "Really? George Washington, what has he done for us lately?" And, he won the Revolutionary, I guess he did, but what since then, you know? And what's with the teeth? And it was, it's just this, so people have always struggled, I think, with that. I have this theory that the internet is something that has outpaced human biology. I don't think our brains are wired to handle it.
I think you're right. I think it's a sense of evolution. So we are now glued to these screens. We carry them around with us everywhere we go, and we get information, we send information, but we're all addicted. I mean, there's an addiction to this dependence upon social media and, you know, the screens on which we read it. And it is especially an experiment on kids. I mean, those of us who, you know, lived without the internet for decades, you know, we're still addicted, don't get me wrong, but it's not the same impact on a developing brain.
Right.
And there's now evidence that this addiction actually changes the way the brain develops.
Reroutes neurons.
It does.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what we're going to do about it. If we had a sensible, normal government, we'd be looking into that to try to figure out what advice we would give to people and what could be done about it. So we're going to have to figure out how to do it ourselves, I guess.
Yeah. Are you going to be, I'm guessing, my guess is no screens is the best way to go for a while when children are growing up. And then at a certain point, you have to start making adjustments.
And I think, Conan, we have to help teach kids in our families and also expecting our schools to be kind of part of this kind of purposeful education so that kids can navigate, like, what is kind of truth and opinion and kind of outright falsehoods.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
In an era where that's not just something kind of that they're reading or they're hearing, but that it is almost surrounding them because of this addiction. Because one of the things I really worry about is just the erosion of truth everywhere.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the reason we're even having a debate about climate change is because somehow, like, it's okay to interrogate and disbelieve science, which right. I think is absurd.
Now, it did feel like I grew up in the 70s, 80s, and I was in a good public school system, and I just kept thinking, oh, we're moving forward. I remember thinking, I had friends that were African-American from, you know, from Roxbury, and I remember thinking, well, we took care of racism, right?
Mm,
I mean,
right.
It's sad that I really remember being about 14 and thinking, well, racism and evolution, we figured that out with the Scopes trial. So we're just moving ahead, you know, and then it feels like the tide surges forward and then it pulls back in this way that's profoundly depressing at times.
Yeah.
Which is why I want to get back to optimism.
Yes, let's get back to optimism because fundamentally we are.
Because, you know, there's so many people in the book, I didn't know Secretary Glenn, about your lifelong attachment to Eleanor Roosevelt. And
right.
I am a big history buff, and I'm a big Roosevelt aficionado. And so I was really interested that you honed in on Eleanor Roosevelt as someone who I could see in the not just the 30s, but also the 40s and the 50s, and really until she dies in 1962,
yeah.
She is this woman who's breaking all the rules. And her advice, one of the things that she said in the book that it feels to me like you've taken to heart is, you got to have a thick skin.
Right.
Like, skin is thick as a rhinoceros, I think she used to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, you might as well do what you want because you'll get criticized anyway.
100%. You know, she was somebody who I knew about when I was growing up. I knew that she was married to President Roosevelt. I knew that she visited American troops in the South Pacific. I knew kind of bits and pieces, but I didn't realize how courageous and resilient she was until some biographies started coming out. And it wasn't until like the 70s and 80s that they pieced together all of her work and her writing and began to provide a fuller portrait of this woman who overcame being orphaned at a very early age, being kind of rejected, having an interesting but challenging life, being a Roosevelt. I mean, at her wedding to Franklin, her Uncle Teddy, you know, gave her away. I mean, she just had all of this weight of responsibility on her, which she rose to fulfill. And she was such an advocate for people who were left out, even with all the good things that Franklin Roosevelt did during the Great Depression to try to lift people up. There were lots of people who were left out and left behind by even the programs that were passed. But I zero in on the book on her singular accomplishment after her husband died, after Truman became president, and he asked her to be part of a very small group that was going to plan the United Nations, you know, so that they could try to prevent the wars of the 20th century from ever happening again. And she was one of the people who wrote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And if you want to feel, you know, a sense of pride to know that right after the Second World War, all these countries that had been devastated by war, populations that had been wiped out in the Holocaust, I mean, people said, we can't let this happen. So how are we going to do it? Yeah, we'll build institutions like the UN or NATO or something. But we need to lift our sights. We need to look at what we could do to treat each other with dignity. And, you know, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the single document that has been printed more in the course of its existence than anything else. I mean, obviously, you know, the Bible's been around for a long time, so it outranks everything. But the Universal Declaration is, you know, way up there. And so Eleanor Roosevelt continues to be an inspiration to me. And at the end of her life, she started getting, you know, very outspoken about, you know, what she expected our country to be able to do to live up to those values. So she's somebody that deserves to be read about on her own.
Yeah. And, you know, another person in the book, Greta Thunberg, who is obviously, what I liked about the book is that there are names I expected to see, you know, and you'd say like, well, Harriet Tubman, you'd expect to see in the book. And there are all these iconic women that I would think, yes, they're going to be in the book. Greta Thunberg's a name I didn't even know a year ago, you know, and what's amazing to me about her is she's so young.
Right.
And I feel like that is part of her secret weapon, is that it's very hard to dismiss someone. I mean, first of all, it's very hard to attack a child, you know.
And although people do.
They do. I know they do.
Including our president.
Yeah. But shamefully. it provides somewhat of a challenge to them, maybe a little bit. Do you know that it's a, and it's always this, there's this ancient wisdom that children speak the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes think there can't be a better climate advocate than someone who's that young, who clearly is not in anybody's pocket, mm-hmm. and who's clearly just saying, don't stop messing up my planet, stop it. And you know, she's one of the people in the book that probably, you know, she wasn't on my radar a year ago. And mm-hmm. so I love that this book encompasses the iconic figures from 200 years ago and someone who's just on the scene right now, who hasn't done her best work yet.
And is challenging all of us to be part of the solution, and also is so fiercely focused on the science.
Right.
I do think part of her superpower is being kind of young and unbowed and just kind of relentlessly saying, you know, how could we not have done more? And how can we let any minute pass given like the crisis that we're confronting? And my mom and I were both so inspired by her kind of initially very lonely effort outside the Swedish parliament, you know, as a single climate striker. And then, you know, a few other people joined, and then a few more, and then a few mm-hmm. more. And just this deep belief she had that her actions could make a difference.
Yeah.
There was something I was thinking about with this book, which is, you know, and obviously someone who I expected to be in the book, Maya Angelou. I believe it was your suggestion to your husband, hey, wouldn't it be great if Maya Angelou read a poem at the first inaugural?
Right. You know, she...
That was you, yes?
Yeah, she was somebody who I came across years before because of her amazing memoir, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, talking about her life growing up in a little town in South Arkansas called Stamps, and you know, the racism and the inequality that she had to cope with, but then being, you know, brutally raped mm-hmm. As a young child, she stopped talking. She became mute. And I find her so inspiring because here's this little kid, and literally she could have just sat in a corner and never come out of it. But instead, while she refused to talk or thought she couldn't talk anymore, she started reading every book she could find, and she started memorizing. She would memorize Shakespeare. She would, you know, memorize long passages from, you know, African-American writers. She would be trying to fill her heart and her head with information, with wisdom. And then when she finally did start to talk again, she was like this changed person. I mean, that voice she had, even as a young woman, was so compelling and powerful. And when, you know, Bill was thinking about planning his inauguration, he'd always loved the fact that President Kennedy had Carl Sandburg mm-hmm. Read a poem, one of his own, at the inauguration. So, you know, we were kicking around ideas for that, and I suggested Maya Angelou, and Bill was immediately receptive, and then she wrote a poem for it. So it was a perfect...
A very optimistic poem.
Very optimistic poem. The Pulse of the Morning. It was so exciting to have her part of that ceremony. And, you know, there was a lot of optimism, but there was also a reminder of how far we'd come, and yet we still needed to keep going further.
I was thinking about this morning before we started this interview, that the first real division is gender. Like, that's mm-hmm. the first initial division in life is mm-hmm. men, women. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's getting, we're learning more now. We're realizing it's a spectrum. It's getting, it's changing and evolving. But that is the first division. And so understanding each other is like the first step. And I think it's been seismic mm-hmm. and uncomfortable for a lot of men mm-hmm. and scary and mm-hmm. and the last couple of years. But there is this necessary, we've got to figure this out. We've got to understand each other. And this book goes a long way towards, I think, doing that. It's just very, you read it, I'd even read it as a this would be good for me to read. Mm. Or it would be good for my daughter to read this. It just feels like, no, I actually think this is a really good book for men to read.
Yeah, I would hope so, Conan. I mean, you're 100% right. And I'm not sure all the reasons why we are so divided and so at loggerheads with each other. And the fact that a lot of what people are pointing fingers at and arguing about are really old problems, whether it's race or gender or religion or ethnicity or immigration status. I mean, things that have been around a long time. And I do think that we're at a pivotal moment in our country's history where people are trying to make sense of what's happening. And a lot of people, like you just said, are trying to say, oh, hey, I've got things to learn. You know, wow, what an opportunity. I can, you know, expand my horizons. I can understand more. And some people are saying, I'm not going there. You know, yeah. I'm digging my heels in right here. And in fact, I'm going to head around and go back from where I came. And I expect others to follow along. So there's a real, I don't want to say philosophical difference, but in some ways it's an experiential one where people are saying, look, okay, yeah, you know what? I'm kind of into this new world. And yeah, it's a little bit confusing and it's not like anything we've had before, but let's make it work. And others are saying, I categorically reject it. I'm not changing and you're going to have to change. And obviously in politics, you can be either the happy warrior, the optimist, the, hey, you know, we are the best positioned country in the history of the world to get this right. Or you can be a fearmonger and a demagogue who is going to point out scapegoats and, you know, give you an excuse for how difficult transitions and change is. And that's where we are. And we've got to bet on optimism. I mean, it's been a kind of congenital American trait that has gotten us through a lot as we've had to change who we were and expand the meaning of citizenship and all the rest of it. If we ever quit betting on optimism, you know, the whole American experiment is at risk. So this is a book that, yes, we were inspired by these women, motivated by them, but it also does carry that larger message. Like, hey, it's possible. You know, some of what these women overcame is almost reminiscent of what people are facing today. Mm-hmm. And look, they got through it. We can get through it and come better out the other side.
Amen.
That was
this is the Conan good, O'Brien, you know, religious hour. Send in your donations.
The number to donate is 1-800. Now the money goes to me,
but that's so he can, you know, represent the, you know, the way of the truth.
Yes,
right.
And also
the path forward.
There's this house I have my eye on in the Cayman Islands, and there's this really good car. It's been an uplifting experience for me, I want to say. And I know that there's a lot of toxicity around politics and craziness. And what I was really looking forward to today was this book is so not about that. This is not a political book. Right. It is just a book about really fundamental human qualities
exactly.
that don't have to be gender specific, but these are women. We're putting the spotlight on women, and it was really inspiring. And just I was very happy to get a chance to sit down and say, I need a dose of this optimism. This was really nice. So I, you know, thank you for agreeing to come here. And this very nice hotel that we booked. This was not cheap, by the way.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Have you revised your feeling about being...
No,
because I was going to say the Joan of Arc thing creeped me out, frankly. Wow. I no longer want to be your friend.
Well, gosh.
We wouldn't let her take matches with her.
You definitely wouldn't let me have matches anyway, probably, until I graduated from high school.
Well, that day, they really didn't want you
to have
matches.
Joan of Arc thing was,
Okay,
thankfully, I wasn't that literal.
She went out the door as Joan of Arc. Were you and your husband at all like, that's a little extreme, the Joan of Arc?
That's right. Be safe and call us if you...
what happened to the ice cream cone, right? Like, what happened to the ice cream cone is probably what my mom was
thinking.
Could
be Wonder Woman or Dora the Explorer, you know?
My daughter was Wonder Woman 1 year.
Oh, was she? That's cool. That's a good costume.
Yeah, we love her.
It was a great costume.
I was Wonder Woman 4 years ago.
Oh, how did that work out for you?
I was escorted to a police station. which
is another story.
We're not telling that story.
Oh, okay. Next time.
Yeah, that would be. Seriously, thank you so much, both of you, for being here. And the book, once again, The Book of Gutsy Women. I have a 16-year-old daughter, and I'm giving her 3 copies of this, and she will have them all.
Great.
And,
thank you.
And I'm going to give my son a copy of this book as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
When I get him to stop playing whatever game he's playing on the internet right now.
You figure out how to say, you know, read a chapter and then you can have another hour or two of, you know, playing the game. You know,
you don't even know what the games are.
I have no idea.
I could see you going, and then you can go back to playing
the games. Games, whatever the games are.
Yeah. Thank you both very much. This was a real joy. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Conan.
Thank you, Conan. It was a lot of fun.
Better work presentations are possible. They're called Canva presentations. You can supercharge your work decks with Canva presentations. Sounds like I know what I'm talking about. Yeah. Just start with a prompt, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides in seconds, or with a stunning template and add images, graphics, charts, and data visualizations from their massive media library. You save time and you wow your audience. Mm-hmm. I have never made one of these presentations and I never will, but there's a reason why Canva is used by 90% of the Fortune 500 companies. 90%!
That's a lot of percent.
Yeah, let's get it to 100%, guys. Come on. Nail your next work presentation with Canva presentations by heading to canva.com. Designed for work. Hey, Sona, do you settle for ordinary in your own home?
No.
Well, you kind of do. Anyway, with Floor and Decor, you don't have to put up with rooms that just look meh. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Meh is kind of a meh phrase these days. Floor and Decor doesn't just have a couple of aisles of options. It's an entire store with the largest selection of tile, wood, and stone in stock and available in job lot quantities. Mm. That's what I need, job lot quantities. And if you're a pro like me, Floor and Decor also has a job site delivery, along with all the brands pros trust for installation. There's also design experts in the store to help you find the right look at the right price. And guess what? It's free.
That's my favorite price.
Free is the best price, yeah. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Unless it's for food. And then I'm like, oh, I'm about to pay a little.
No, I like free food, too.
Well, it can be scary. Anyway, we got off track. You can resist the ordinary and find more ways to wow with Floor and Decor.
You guys want to check in on a voicemail?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. I mean, with some trepidation.
You're safe. It's good.
Okay.
Will, if you could play it, please.
Hey, Conan. This is Mark, and I live in Twin Falls, Idaho. Hey, I know you're a big fan of history stuff, and my parents are coming out here this summer, and there's not really much history in Twin Falls, or there might be. I don't know. But I was wondering if you could maybe make up a fake history story that I could trick my parents with about the Twin Falls area. Thanks.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting challenge. You could say that it's very little known fact that during his very short tenure as president, Gerald Ford went missing for a while. He was only president for about 2 years. He was, of course, the interim president between Nixon and Carter. But little known fact, sometime around 1975 in the fall, Ford disappeared. They didn't know where he was. Ford, of course, famously played football in college. Some people thought that he had sustained a lot of concussions. In just a moment of dementia from one of his many concussions, left the White House because he was under the belief that he was a mailman who worked in Twin Falls, Idaho. So the Secret Service went looking. They didn't know where he was. And it's 1975. They didn't have all the kind of GPS tracking they have today. And they found him as a letter carrier in Twin Falls, Idaho. He was revived. He was reassured that he was the president of the United States. He was given some smelling salts. They applied a hot mustard plaster to his chest. And over a period of time, he recovered. And he finished out his presidency. But for 2.5 months in the fall of 1975, President Gerald Ford was a letter carrier in Twin Falls, Idaho.
How did he get to Idaho?
Well, he hitched a ride.
Okay.
He hitched for a while, and some hippies picked him up, and they're like, hey, man, you look like Gerald Ford, man. And he's like, I don't know who I am. And, you know, they were like, yeah, we're hippies, man. I mean, yeah, the 60s are over, man, but not that far over. Yeah, man. They're only like 5 years ago, man, the 60s. So, like, it's plausible that we're still hippies, man. Yeah, man. Yeah, and these hippies talked exclusively about how they were still hippies in 1975.
They were justifying their existence.
That's all they pretty much talked about. And so that's how Ford was able to get away with. They didn't ask Ford a lot of questions because they spent most of the ride in this VW bus justifying, yeah, man. I mean, it's plausible, man. It's like 69 is like Woodstock, and this is like 6 years later, man. Yeah, man, totally plausible, man.
How did Ford get the job, or was he just doing it as a hobby?
Well, first of all, he had an excellent resume. I mean, he had...
He had his resume on him.
He had lost...
The forethought to bring his resume.
He had lost a lot of his, memory, but he did remember, that he had been on the Warren Commission. He did remember that he had served faithfully in the Congress, and that he also remembered being vice president. And so he just forgot the president part.
And did his wife go with him, or he just took off?
No. He totally was so happy to just take a break.
Wait, going back to his resume, you said he was a president on the resume, but that he forgot. Oh,
he was vice president.
Uh-huh.
You got to listen in improv.
I'm sorry. He remembered he was vice president.
He remembered that he was vice president. He just didn't know what he was president.
Oh, okay.
He forgot Nixon's resignation. Look, these questions didn't make what I said any funnier.
No, but I'm just trying to figure it out.
You're blaming the questions?
What I'm doing is I'm hang gliding beautifully, and you guys are throwing bank safes at me with your questions. Catch this. And that's hurting my beautiful arcing dives, my twirls, my pirouettes, if you will. Anyway.
All right, let's let you hang glide. We'll back off. Go for it.
Anyway, I thought that was a pretty good answer.
That was good.
Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, with Sona Movsesian and Conan O'Brien as himself. Produced by me, Matt Gourley. Executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Earwolf. Theme song by The White Stripes. Incidental music by Jimmy Vivino. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, and our associate talent producer is Jennifer Samples. The show is engineered by Will Becton. You can rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review featured on a future episode. Got a question for Conan? Call the Team Coco hotline at 323-451-2821 and leave a message. It too could be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Pandora makes it easy for you to find your favorite music. Discover new artists and genres by selecting any song or album, and we'll make you a personalized station for free. Download on the Apple App Store or Google Play and enjoy the soundtrack to your life.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. In fact, Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/podcastfree. All lowercase, shopify.com/podcastfree, shopify.com/podcastfree.